You're listening to an American Theater podcast. American Theater is published by Theater Communications Group. www.americantheater.org.
Welcome back to Off Script, American Theater's podcast of all things theatrical. After a holiday break, I'm Rob Weinert-Kent, Editor-in-Chief. I'm here with...
Susie Evans, I'm the Senior Editor.
Deep Tran, Associate Editor.
And we're back with lots of things to talk about. News does not take a break, even though we did. There was a lot of... I'll just tease what we're going to talk about. A little bit about some of the news things we reported. Then we'll talk about Mother Courage. And we're setting up an interview we have later in the hour with Tanya Pinkins, the erstwhile star of Classical Stage Company's Mother Courage. She left it rather publicly, as many of you might know. And we'll set that up, and then we'll come back and do recommendations. So let's start off with the news. I'm just going to lead off with one thing with two deaths that had me a little bit reeling. Last week, I was shocked to hear that Liz Suatos died, and she's a theatrical composer who... I hadn't seen a lot of her work, but there was a book by her called Listening Out Loud about becoming a composer, and that was once an aspiration of mine as well. And that book had a huge impact on me, and I met her and did a feature on her when she did a show at the Flea. Aaron Courtney has written a wonderful in memoriam for her. Liz died last week of cancer. And then, of course, everyone knows that today, I'm not going to choke up, David Bowie, who's a cultural icon, and, you know, one who... infused theater into all that he did. In fact, I just found a quote from him on a Dinah Shore broadcast from the mid-70s in which he said, "I act the songs rather than sing them." And I think that's true. Anyway.
He went to Mars, as I've been telling people.
What's that?
He went to Mars.
Yeah. Well, he went somewhere. It's emotional for me because he meant a lot to me, and it's a complete shock. His impact reached across many media, film, fashion, music, and theater. So, other news of comings and goings, Susie, we've reported these on our website.
Yes, we had about a week. I think it was last week where it seems like every major theater leader in the country was just jumping around to different theaters. It's, you know, new year, new you, new jobs, people maybe fulfilling their New Year's resolutions. I don't know what's going on. So I'll do a little rundown of all the changes the theater industry can expect. We have and one of the more high-profile ones, they're all pretty high-profile, I shouldn't judge, Jennifer Bielstein, the managing director of Actors Theater of Louisville for the past 10 years, has just announced that she is going to become the new managing director of the Guthrie Theater in Minneapolis. As many of you know, the Guthrie Theater also had a new artistic director this season in Joseph Hodge. So new team at the top of that theater.
Cool.
Another big change is Christopher Minnelli is leaving Chicago's Victory Gardens and going to Geva Theater Center in Rochester, New York, to become the managing director there and also the co-CEO. Another long-anticipated piece of news is that Paige Evans of LCT3, the new play development hub at Lincoln Center Theater, is going to become the new artistic director of Signature Theater. Last year, the founder and artistic director, Jim Houghton, announced medical reasons that he was stepping down. Mm-hmm. And so they've been on a long search for a new artistic director, and I believe Paige starts in July, and Jim will stay on as in the role of founder.
Yeah.
Another big announcement with no replacement announced yet, but Sheldon Epps has announced that he's going to step down from Pasadena Playhouse at the end of the 2016-17 season. He's been there for 20 years and done a lot for the community there, so I'm sure they're on a big national search for a new artistic director in Pasadena. And then finally, Robert Hupp is going to leave Arkansas Repertory Theater for Syracuse Stage.
And that was one where Tim Bond announced some time ago, and I was just talking to someone recently, when are they going to announce the replacement? And they have.
Now they have. So lots of changes, but they all sound exciting, and, you know, some open positions if you're looking for a high-powered theater. You know, Actors Theater probably needs a new managing director. Pasadena Playhouse needs a new artistic director. LCT3 needs a new artistic director.
It's funny. There's a number of folks going from the south to colder climates. I noticed there. Louisville, well, it's not the south, it's Plains, I suppose. But,
yeah.
Joe Hodge had a tweet recently, I think it was, or Facebook, something about, like, had the picture of the weather in Minneapolis, because he was in Playmakers in Chapel Hill, mm-hmm. and now he's in Minneapolis. Like, how is there negative degrees? Like, he doesn't understand. It's like, well, negative two in Minneapolis.
What's funny is most of them are, like, moving region from a whole different region.
Yeah, exactly. The Bob only Huff person, going to Syracuse.
I mean, Paige is the only one who's going from New York to New York.
Right, right.
We have, you know, Chicago to New York. We have Louisville to Minneapolis, Arkansas to New York. It's a lot of moves.
It's not usually very new, though. Theater artistic directors, imagine directors moving like across the country.
Yeah, I know.
Oh, yeah, no, it's a little weird. They're all happening in the same week.
Yeah, that is true. I know. Yes. That was a fun day for us.
Lots of news to report. Was there other news, Deep?
Yes. Over the break, two theaters announced that they were closing. Performance Network Theater in Ann Arbor, Michigan is closing after 34 years, and Red Moon in Chicago is closing after 25 years. And then we got back from break, and it was announced that Impact Theater in Berkeley, California is also closing after 20 years. They all cited financial reasons, you know, lack of contributed income and lowering of grants. And in Red Moon's case, it was also real estate because their landlord was suing them for not paying rent.
Yeah.
Didn't they recently, this is just big knowledge, I don't know if I'm correct, move to Pilsen in southern Chicago from a place in the city? It's a little bit hard to get to. It's not the South Side. It's mainly known as like Mexican neighborhood, Latino neighborhood.
Yeah.
And it's gorgeous. There's a lot of great art galleries. I've been there, great food, but it's, you know, not really in a central area to get to. And they had this big idea that they were going to like rent out the space for events, and they didn't get a lot of demand because it wasn't in the most accessible area.
Huh. I didn't know that.
And so some people have said that might be a reason why, because they had this kind of high rent because they got this big space down in Pilsen. But nobody wanted to rent an event space in Pilsen. It's not really the South Side of Chicago, but it's not as easy to get to as other neighborhoods, and so it's interesting.
Well, each of these had a different sort of backstory and sort of type of theater they were. In case Performance Network, I mean, Red Moon also had the business with their big fire festival.
Oh yeah, their big fire festival, and the city dropped all of its funding.
But Performance Network Theater, we wrote some coverage of when they. It was very confusing reporting because I got releases from people saying we're closing, and then another group of people saying, "Oh, we're taking over." So some new management came in to try to save Performance Network last season, and obviously it didn't work out.
Yeah, well, they were going to close because they had like three figures worth of debt, and then a new team was able to lower that down substantially, but they weren't able to like fundraise enough to mount a full. So sustain a full season.
Right. And Impact was just similarly just strapped financially. And, you know, San Francisco is not, Berkeley is not an easy real estate market.
Well, yeah. And they have Berkeley Rep, which is already a huge theater there. But I think Deep did a great piece that's online. It's an interview with the Impact's artistic director.
Melissa Hillman.
Yeah. About kind of how, why it closed and also what the future means, because it's been such a great incubator for Bay Area artists. And so Melissa still wants to find a way to still support those artists, and maybe it's not through a theater company, but there's definitely going to be some sort of future of what their mission was.
That's true. That's true. It didn't completely – impact will not completely go away, lose its impact entirely. Is there any other news we want to report or links we should talk about on our website?
Yes. I just want to preview two pieces that will be coming out in the upcoming weeks at americantheater.org. Background. This is January. And January in New York, if you are a fan of downtown theater, there's a veritable bonanza of theater festivals. Like, every year, there just seems to be like a new festival or two that I've never heard of featuring artists whose work I have never seen doing some really weird things. And so it all started 12 years ago when Mark Russell at the Public Theater founded the Under the Radar Festival, which is a festival of international and American experimental multidisciplinary work. And then that led to the COIL Festival at PS122, which is of the same vein. And then now we have Prototype, which is a big opera theater festival. And then there's American Realness, which has a dance component. And this year we're going to run a piece about the new Exponential Festival, which is Brooklyn-based, and it's just Brooklyn artists producing experimental work. And plug, former AET staffer Eliza Bent's show Toilet Time is getting...
Toilet Fire.
Oh, sorry. Toilet Fire.
You think it used to be called Toilet
Time?
Yeah,
it used to be called Toilet Time.
Oh, I didn't
Change
remember
of title.
I don't remember
yeah.
that. Toilet Fire is much better. It's a much more evocative image. But go on.
It's a very violent image, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
And it's running at the Exponential Festival, and apparently, I don't know what day it is. I think it's this Sunday. She's going to have her husband, Dave Malloy, on stage as the choir, the pianist,
oh, really? He's
during
the
show.
Piano
yes.
Oh, wow. Great. Well, that would almost be worth going to see that. One of the super couples of power couples of New York theater. And the reason the festival started, of course, it should be noticed, is APAP has its annual, this is the American Performing Arts Presenters Organization.
Yes, yes.
And they come here like basically shopping for things to take to their venues all over the country. And I think that's why Under the Radar started, right? Initially to sort of expose this work. It's like, let's do it in January when other theaters are dark and.
Yeah, I think Under the Radar started first, and then APAP started having their January
oh, really?
Gatherings
okay.
here, and then more.
And then more festivals.
Yeah,
okay.
And also January is dark for Broadway, and so there's no openings this
dark-ish,
month. So.
Dark-ish.
Yeah. Darking, there's yeah. things opening.
Things are slowish. How's that? The festival season is upon us.
It's horrible because it's mostly within this two-week period, and so you're just going to show after show. And not
what
getting
a
very
hard
much sleep.
Life.
I know, right?
That's
it's
so
like
horrible.
That was my weekend.
Oh, poor you. Isn't there another story online that you want to talk about, Deeb?
Oh, and one more big piece of news that's on the AET website is in January we ran this letter from the executive director of TCG,
yes.
Teresa Eyring. And she was talking about the need for color-conscious casting, not color-blind casting, not casting that ignores the race of individuals but considers the inequities of the field and casts that way.
Right.
And so it was a letter that we released prior to it running in our print issue, and then we garnered 1,300 signatures, which we then ran on our website last week, and mm-hmm. it's now at 20,000 hits, which is pretty exciting. Mm-hmm. And for once, there are no angry people writing into us telling us that we're being racist.
Right.
So,
were there any
nice.
Comments on Facebook? Sometimes the weirdos come out on
oh,
Facebook.
There were definitely comments.
There
on
are
Facebook,
definitely
yeah.
comments, but in comparison to, you know, that piece we ran by Dominic Morso or the pieces that I've written there, yeah. I think they're used to it by now.
Okay. Another controversial thing related to casting came up, and that's why we talked to Tanya Pinkins. I'll just set that up, that interview, really quickly. Spoke to Tanya, who I saw many years ago in Carolina Change on Broadway. She was Tony nominated for that. She's an amazing actress and has very strong opinions and differed very strongly with Brian Kulik, the director of Classic Stage Company's Mother Courage, and with the way he was running things. We had, I think, a good conversation. We brought up a few things which Deep thinks I should probably annotate in advance. One of them is Rashida Speaking, we refer to in passing, was a play at the New Group, and I don't remember the name of the writer. Rashida Speaking, it was directed by Cynthia Nixon, I know that, and it was with Diane Wiest. So she refers to that actually in a letter she wrote about her problems even performing in that. Even though she was proud of her work in that and didn't leave that show, she I think the quote was she found it soul murdering to work in that show.
Rashida Speaking?
Yep.
Yes.
Really?
You know, yeah. Well, you could hear about it. Just she felt she was the only person of color in the room defending and speaking for that, and you know.
And the show is also about like he said she said of race.
Yeah, it's
related.
A little bit. Yeah, it's a little
indeterminate.
I talked
to her when she was in that show so briefly. It was at like an event, but she was like glowing about working with Diane Wiest, and she was like so happy.
Well, she did. I mean, she made it apart from being able to work with that great cast. She found it soul murdering, and you know, all right, you'll hear the conversation. I mean, she just clearly had differed with Brian Kulik just from like his conception of the whole thing, and then eventually left it. You know, and I saw her in the final preview, as we talked about. She did play it all the way through a certain preview of January 3rd. And it was, you know, almost fully realized performance and production. But in any case, we also refer to the August Wilson essay that's we're about to celebrate 20 years of a famous speech he gave actually at the TCG conference in 96 called The Ground on Which I Stand. And it was very controversial and also inspiring for lots of folks. not to sum it up too briefly, but essentially it was a call for there to be more culturally specific theaters, theaters of color, producing their own work by writers of color. Most controversially, he deplored the practice of white theaters casting actors of color in classics as a way of, and found it disrespectful and didn't understand why you wouldn't cast white actors in Raisin in the Sun in reverse. So it sort of presaged a lot of the debates we've had since then. You know, we're coming up on the 20th anniversary of that. It seems like something that's still in the air and still an unresolved issue. And so we talked a little bit about that. Just in case anyone doesn't know what the ground on which I stand is, that's what we're referring to. So,
and it's also valuable to note that this version of Mother Courage and Her Children that was done at Classic Stage Company is set in the Congo. And we ran a really great essay on our website about whether Brecht and also other classics that's commonly done like Shakespeare, if it can be reset in different times, and if it does, like how do you preserve the specificity of the location and whether Brecht can speak to the black experience.
Right. I mean, I think one takeaway, not to spoil it, is Tanya does think it can. And there were other cases of plays, but it not the way that was done here. So without further ado, let's hear what Tanya had to say. So I'm here with Tony Pinkins, Tony winner, multiple Tony nominee, a force of nature, and a real star. And she made a lot of news recently, as you might have seen, and was on our website as well as all over the theater media, for the production of Mother Courage at Classic Stage Company, which she departed publicly and had a lot of reasons for it. We'll talk a little bit about that, but I think also about the larger issues she raised in about the production, which I think have resonance for the field in general. So I happened to see the last performance with you on Sunday. And, you know, it's,
you don't have to be nice for
no,
me.
No, no, here. I'll say this. Because it wasn't a press, Mark Thibodeau didn't invite me. I can't really review it per se. I can say that I saw a glimpse of what could be. And also, I should just sidebar and say, production's going to go on and Keisha Lewis is playing. And that was previewed. So, It may become more of what it's
frozen,
right? Yeah, exactly. The text is locked and the staging is locked. It may become more. It may become something different. So I shouldn't comment again. I wasn't reviewing, so I shouldn't comment too closely. But it was, of course, interested in your relationship to it because you had spoken publicly and some of your castmates had spoken semi publicly about it as well. I wonder what that last performance was like for you and how the rest of the week has been.
It's been great. I feel like what I spoke about hit a nerve, and so there's positive, there's negative, and that means it's important. The fact that there's just this conflict, and I want that conversation to keep going.
Right, right. And you obviously, it was not a decision you took lightly.
Oh, not
by
at
any
all.
Means.
No.
And so,
no,
you don't have any regrets about the way that either. Pulling out or the way that it's gone since then.
No regrets like whatsoever.
Generated a good discussion.
I think it's been a fantastic, probably, you know, the best possible thing.
Right. Okay. I mean, I think we'll talk about some of the issues that you talked about, but I think the line about how your Mother Courage was just too big for this and it didn't fit, you know?
Well, and I think people, that's sort of like, you know, you take that as a statement. It's that my work requires specificity.
Okay.
So the very fact that Brian says, I just want to do a general Congo.
Yeah.
I don't work like that. And I don't know anybody who works like that. So
sure.
General, I mean, you see auditions and you see an actor who comes in and they're general. You don't want to hire them.
Yeah.
The more specific the choice is, the more universal it becomes. So that refusal to commit to things was very, very difficult. So I can't work without making very specific choices.
Well, so I can't comment on my opinion of it, but I can certainly report and talk about it. It's evident from what you and Brian said in the statements that rather than replace the place names, of Mother Courage, you know, Riga and Finnish regiment. He just stripped them out.
He right. just His removed adaptation. Them, which just, means you remove out. Place from the from right. the story right. altogether. So now we're in a fantasy land.
Right. I mean, what I wonder, and this is not devil's advocate so much to say, is, and I'm sure this was the
Be
conversation.
Devil's advocate, that's good.
Yeah, well, yeah. If it was the part of the conversation, like, if you're going to change and put specific references, it does become an adaptation. It's a different play. If arguably, it could be a different play. I know.
Well, you know, one of the things I think the Columbia student talked about was, you know, can you put a black view on Brecht?
Yeah.
And it's already been done.
Yeah,
the
yeah.
public commissioned Intozaki Shange to do Mother Courage in the 80s.
Yeah, no.
So it's been done. And I know that no one on this production ever even referenced it because Martha Tenney at the Barnard Library had to dredge it from her archives for me because I wanted okay. to see how it changed when that specific eye was put on it.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
nobody else bothered to even look at that.
Yeah, someone else put a link in Twitter. There have been African productions in Africa.
Oh yes, you know. And someone sent me there was Uganda. They yeah. did them in an African language, so it's been done.
Right, so a black perspective can be put on Brecht,
yes.
and vice versa. Now, let me get to the. I didn't see the Intozaki Shange's production, but the conversation about it reminds me of one of the. I'm sort of a Brecht head, you
okay.
know, like, but.
If you're a Brecht head, we can go in.
A little bit, you know.
Let's go in.
I don't want to pull rank on it, but, you know, it's
That's
just...
That's fine.
You study this role more than I've ever studied it, but...
But let's just...
The conversation... Going about
Brecht.
Yeah.
Brecht was talking about his own time. He was talking about fascism. But instead of putting it in fascism, he said it in the 30 Years' War.
Right.
So to me, that lets you know that he took something from his time and he put it somewhere else, which to me gives you license to put it anywhere because that's what he did.
Right. You could... So he sets it up. The other thing I think was interesting to me as someone who knows the play really well, Or just, I love the play. I don't know it that well.
It's a great
play.
And
I really liked, I was one of the people who loved the public version with Meryl and, that Tony did. I really love that. But just to be able to see the play. And actually, even this production, which again, I shouldn't comment whether I liked it or not, it was just to see the play on the stage. It's still, and to read it up to it was still, has an effect on me. But there's inherent in the character and the way Brecht wrote it, there's an ambivalence and there's a complication. As you wouldn't deny that. And I feel like that argument over whether she's a survivor or delusional, I would say my reading of the play is that she's both in many ways. And that Brecht, when he was the first staging of it, he was worried that people liked her too much. So he changed a few things to make her seem at key points a little less likable. Now, likable is pretty relative. I think because his point was that she's implicated in a way that he wants us to feel like she's not, as you say about Caroline, we were speaking earlier, she's not a hero, right?
For me, in looking at the play, I yeah. thought, well, maybe I can come up with the one that Brecht would say, yes, that's right. who I wanted Mother Courage to be, right. that one.
Right, right, right.
I mean,
right.
if you notice that I made the choice at the end, you know, Helena Weigel, you know, pulled some money out and decided I'm going to take some back.
Yes.
I made the choice. No, I'm not giving you any money. Because you know what? One of my kids is buried in a pit. This one can be buried in a pit too. I need this money.
Right. Okay. Yeah. I was sitting where I couldn't see. So you gave them a little bit.
I didn't give them any.
Okay.
All right. Started to, and I gave no money because I believe my Mother Courage was not burying any child. One didn't get buried, so this other one is not more special than the others.
Okay.
And I need this money.
Okay.
Wow. That was my choice. Certainly. The director didn't agree with it, so it wasn't even lit so that the audience could actually see that choice okay. was being made.
So it wasn't a matter of – you weren't trying to make her more sympathetic. It wasn't
I wanted to go in and see, can I do what Brecht intended
yeah, okay.
and have this woman who is just hardcore.
Right, right. Because on the surface, it read a little bit like you were, as many actors do, advocating for your character. Like, and then he was saying, but you know, in the larger structure of the play, we have to see her as – part of the problem as well as...
I was advocating for my character to go to the end of the line.
Yeah, yeah.
And I can't go to the end of the line if actors are telling me they won't play with my choices.
Okay.
I think my problem with the actor saying, oh, you can't do that is let's play the scene. And let's see the scene that happens if you think I can't do it.
Yeah,
then there's
yeah,
some
yeah.
drama.
Right,
but if
right.
you're just going to make a decision that I can't do this and then we're not going to even explore it, that you don't need to be an actor.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Let's talk about the larger question you asked, because you also brought up Rashida Speaking. Mm-hmm. And how that experience. I'm sorry I didn't see you in that, but I heard you were amazing.
You could see it on PBS. It's online. You could stream it.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Really? Okay. Mm-hmm. I'll do that right away. Because I heard you were amazing.
Well, thank you.
It was striking to read, and I heard another colleague of mine, Mark Blankenship, interview you about the show, that it was a hard experience for you to do that show.
Yes.
I think the criticism I read of the show was that it was almost intended to create varying responses in the audience, and that the playwright hadn't really decided which side.
Well, to me, that would say that that was kind of the best thing about
the
play.
That was the best thing about the play, right.
He was so honest in some of the interchanges that it made people uncomfortable, that
right.
He really hit a nerve. So that, to me, was the best of the play.
So the tough thing was you said you were the only black voice in the room, right? Black artist in the room, represent.
You know, I've been doing this professionally for 40 years, so I'm very often the only black voice in the room. And I think when you get to be the other side of the century, you know, on your way, there are just certain things that you believe people should have grown in or learned about, and the sort of cognitive dissonance that exists in our culture in America, it's in the theater. So you have people still denigrating what it is to be black, but they got to go get a tan. Or they talk about black people's big lips, but they're putting fillers in. Or you have police officers saying, I feared for my life, so I shot this unarmed 12-year-old, yet we don't have women police officers shooting them, and yet people are able to struggle with this dissonance, and that happens in the theater when people decide, hey, I know black people, I'm going to do a story about black people. And really, for me, if you haven't grown up with it in your house or married into it, your perspective is probably going to be inaccurate. And you can't actually trust people who work for you to give you an accurate perspective, because they're dependent on you in some
way. Because they're working for you.
They're working for you. So they need to make you happy. So you'd have to go, well, who do I know who's lived that, that can come in and create that for me? But I think as a black person, I always have to assume that I don't know everything, because that's how the world treats me anyway.
Okay.
So I would call for other male and white artists to just assume what happens if you assume, when you're thinking about someone who's not like you, that you're probably not accurate.
Right.
If you just started from that assumption, I'm not going to be accurate about someone who's not like me.
But so is it enough to come in with that kind of humility? Or is it? Should it be also? I mean, maybe it's both things, that you'd also need to bring in other perspectives and other voices into the room.
I think both. I was told by the members of the cast of Color Purple that John Doyle came into the room and said, "This is not my story to tell."
Right.
And when they asked me to do it, I said no. And they came back to me again, and I said, can I reach down inside myself and go into Alice Walker's world? And for me, that's reflected in this production. And I immediately, you know, was like, I got to meet this John Doyle. I got to know this John Doyle.
Right.
You saw that. You saw his humility about these people, and you saw him allowing these artists to show him truths that he could never know.
Right. Well, and, you know, he's coincidentally
taking over CSC.
And I don't miss. I mean, Brian's done great work there, and you know, it's not about his entire legacy here is not on the line. But the points you raise are important. I wonder the larger question also about doing classics. I mean, we just said Brecht has been done this way; has been adapted.
It's been adapted.
Obviously, Shakespeare's done a lot with. Now, I think one of the differences between this and maybe other productions of classics. Sometimes there'll be like what's I think miscalled colorblind casting, where you just find the best actor, and it's a mixed race, multicultural cast, and race is not referred to or made a part of the text.
And that's fine.
And that's fine too, although that has its issues.
It does. But, when you're going to make Martin Luther King white, that might
have that's a whole other thing. That's a whole other thing. But you know, a Shakespeare where it's a mixed race cast, but then to specifically cast an all black cast or an all Asian cast, like they did with Awake and Sing recently.
Right, Awake and Sing, which was fabulous.
But you know, they didn't set that in China, right?
No.
They didn't. Do you think that this production could have worked? You think, or was it doomed from the start to just take Brecht and set it in the Congo?
Well, if I were to go into all the details of the production,
okay, sure, sure.
It was doomed from the start.
Okay, all right.
And I didn't know all the details that I learned along the way,
right.
Such as our composer would never be present.
Yeah.
Never be present. He didn't watch a rehearsal. He didn't hear anyone sing. He came to a first preview. So
That,
you know, gets into Noam Paniowski, the ignorance gaze. It is incredibly arrogant and ignorant to imagine that you can compose a new musical.
Right.
And never be there.
Right.
And never be there. And I saw that you commented and said you loved the song Song of Solomon. Great song.
Yeah,
wrong place, wrong time in a show.
Yeah,
it's a rock and roll song at the moment when we're begging and we have nothing.
Yeah.
There were things that were just, had I known?
Yeah.
I assumed that the music director, who they let me choose who I wanted, was going to actually arrange the songs because they're in the room watching how the play is being played.
Yeah.
And they're going to say, the arrangement needs to be this for the story we're telling. And then I find out I'm getting tracks from someone who's never seen my work.
Okay, yeah.
And
I
said, I'm a great actress who sings.
Right.
I can't act inside of some tracks.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. You didn't mention this in your letter, and I don't mean to disparage Duncan's work, but in general. But I will say that
he's a brilliant composer,
but how arrogant
to think you can compose some music from across the globe for people you don't know for a show you've never seen.
Right. That's one area where Tony's costumes, I thought were good. But if you're looking at one area where the Congo, you would want to hear the sound of the Congo, it's not in Duncan's score, right?
And the other song that you said you liked, the Grand Capitulation, that particular arrangement, I paid another arranger, Jerome Brooks III, to put percussion on that track because the original, I couldn't even do the song.
Right. Actually, I did like that too, although I thought it was way truncated, but that's another issue you had.
But I mean, I'm saying that arrangement, percussion was added by someone else.
But it was actually the song of Fraternization. I just like
Fraternization. What is that?
That's the one that the prostitute sings.
Oh,
I just like
you
the
like
tune.
That song.
Like the tune. Yeah, it's a good.
All of the songs are beautiful.
Yeah,
there's no doubt. But arrangement is what sets a song in a place and time. If you look at the two Spring Awakenings, the arrangements are completely different.
That's true.
And it makes for a completely different show.
This was all. Most of this was clear from what you wrote, but it's becoming clearer, I think. I've mentioned this to you to an email that we're coming up on the 20th anniversary of August Wilson's Ground on Which I Stand speech, and I was thinking about what he would think. I mean, I don't know what he would have thought of. And
he probably would have said, "Why are you using Brecht? There's a lot of African American playwrights who can write this story. In fact, Lynn Nottage did it already."
I think so. Yeah, exactly. I mean, he had a problem, I think, with African American artists of color doing classics in that way, right? Which I don't know. I don't almost know no artists of color who actors of color who agree with him on the letter of that.
And yeah, so
the spirit they might with the idea that really we should, you know, artists of color should be creating their own work and have their own theaters and their own.
Agreed. I cannot disagree with that. But you know what? When a writer writes something that's so specific, it becomes universal, and you want to play it.
Yeah.
Lucy Thurber couldn't be further from me than the moon.
Right.
And yet when I see her plays, I recognize that part of my life of being the person who doesn't fit into the world they were born in and then doesn't fit into the world that their mind allows them to walk in.
Yeah.
Because it's so specific. And so would I love to play one of Lucy Thurber's plays and play it all black? Absolutely.
Yeah,
because there's some truths in there that I'm like, I want to play that.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's not about the specificity that Brecht had in his play was maybe stripped from this one. And I want to focus just on this one, but this happens in adaptations a lot. And the specificity is not so much about his time or the 30 Years' War, but it's about that play works in a certain way. It has mechanics that works a certain way.
Yes.
And if you just change it or just take the stuff out, it's going to work differently, and it's not going to have the same.
The cart in Brecht's notes, he says, is another character. It's a child.
Right.
The cart is another character in this play. That was stripped from this production.
Right.
Because the Jeep, when I finally got the two-page essay on why the Jeep, what I learned, and that was in tech, was that the Jeep was actually their focus for the play.
Okay.
Their design focus was the play was about the Jeep.
Right.
And the idea of the Jeep as this monster of the war. And you'd see it partially this way, and then you'd see it partially that okay. way. And my argument was, it undermines all of Mother Courage, the character. Mother Courage pulling a useless Jeep. Mother Courage would have sold the rubber. She would have sold the metal. She would have sold the horn.
Yeah,
she would have
yeah.
sold everything about that Jeep. So the fact that she, first of all, nobody could, would ever, people push cars. They don't pull Jeeps or cars.
Right, right.
It's
right.
like, it's nonsensical.
Right. Well,
it's
yeah.
It's suicidal.
I mean, what you're talking about, then you're talking about specificity of the, you're going to Ashford.
But that's their vision. Their vision was, yes, this is how delusional she is.
Oh, I see.
And
I see.
It's like Fitzcarraldo by Werner Herzog.
Oh, okay.
And the man pulling the ship over the Andes. Well, in that movie, he actually did that. He got the scientists and the people to do it. But you want to transplant that to, here's Mother Courage
yeah,
trying
yeah,
to
I
do
gotcha.
The impossible. It's just all in someone's head and not the reality of what actors have to play on the stage.
I gotcha. I gotcha. Yeah, I just, it reminds me, I just saw Fiddler last night and imagining Mother Courage without her cart is like imagining Tevye without his cart. Like,
mm-hmm.
That's a character that he has to pull around. His horse is never, I don't know.
Right, and I never got to pull the cart and I couldn't sell out of the cart. And
well, until the end you
well,
got it,
Well,
that
right? was a fight.
Okay.
That was a Tanya going, I'm putting my foot down.
Yeah,
one moment in this play, I'm pulling my cart and, you know, and then they didn't support that because
right.
it's like the cart has to have had a journey. Take the canopy off so the audience can see her pulling the cart. With this canopy covering it, nobody can even see it.
Right, right.
And light for that. No. Okay,
right.
you want to pull the cart, you can pull the cart. We're not going to let that be a moment.
Right. It makes me think devil's advocate a little bit. Like, okay, so if you're going to be contemporary about it, would a person in this war be pulling a cart, or would she be doing something else? Right?
She might have a bicycle.
Right.
She might have some grocery carts.
But
she wouldn't have a Jeep.
Right. Okay. Right. All right.
She would not have a Jeep. Because if anybody saw her, they'd take the Jeep, and it's not practical.
Right.
It just has no, it has no use, and she is all about what's the use? What can you do for me right now?
Right. Right. Right, yeah. It's if you look at the play, despite its big scope, it's really just a series of negotiations. Every
That's
scene
it.
Is like, what can I get out of this? Oh, I just lost my kid. Okay, well, what can I, you know?
Yeah.
Right. I don't mean to change the subject on you, but have you directed before? Are you considered
yes.
directing? You have.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, so I mean, you have a vision of these plays, which I'm sure some people tell you is bigger than what an actor usually does or should do.
I'm directing right? inside a play.
Right.
I do not go in and go, I want to be great and I want to steal the show. I go in and I go, so how do I fit into the vision the director has conceived for me for the play? And I'm thinking about fitting into every moment of that and how that's how I see it. I don't know how to see any other way. I see the whole play. How does the lighting, how does the sound, how
right.
does every single aspect of the play fit into the journey?
Right.
As I said, this Fitzcarraldo Werner Herzog thing was not communicated to me until 6 weeks into the production.
Okay.
And if I had known, I would have been like, oh, I'm not the one.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not the one.
For that, right.
Right.
Right, right. So I also would like to ask you about Carolina Change, since we spoke about that, and that I saw you in that a couple times, and I loved it. And that's what we talked about earlier. She's a complicated character who...
Oh, yeah, I wanted to say that.
Yeah.
Complicated. Yes, Mother Courage can have moments of delusion. You can have
okay,
it
sure.
as part of her, but that's got to be in a complicated thing. When you find out that that's the vision for the whole piece and it's going to be put on the stage in the form of the Jeep, that is...
Okay.
That's very different than a person having moments of delusion. That's very different. Yes, all of us have everything. All of us have murderers in us.
Yeah.
All of us have
yeah.
everything in us.
Right, right. Sure. I mean, she's cradling her dead daughter and as if she's asleep. So there's a delusional aspect to that. Right?
Absolutely.
So yeah, I mean, but Carolina Change also, again, if you wanted to press the point, she's a Mother Courage-like figure, but not really. But she is someone who's distorted by racism and by injustice, who can't really transcend it at the end, really. In a way, maybe spiritually transcends it, but she really, she's tragic, wouldn't
but
you say?
An interesting, I don't think she's tragic. An interesting
okay.
sort of story about that is, before the final workshop, before we started production at the Public, there was a different version of Lot's wife.
Okay.
And, oh my God, it was fantastic. So fantastic that no one will give me a copy of it. They don't want me to know and I can't find mine. And when I came back to do the production, it was missing from the script. There was just nothing there.
Nothing.
Nothing. And I just have such great respect for George and Tony and Janine. I was just like, okay, they know what they're doing. I got to trust them. So when we finally got to the rehearsal for Lot's Wife, they were saying we're starting with a new song. And I was like, well, what was wrong with that song?
Yeah.
And they said, well, when you sang that song, the show was over.
I got you. Yeah.
And Tony was very committed to the future goes on through the children.
Yeah.
And so they wanted to rewrite a song that had, that left the possibility for the epilogue with the children. But there was a version in which that was it.
Okay. All right. And you, I mean, did you, and you, and you felt, was your playing it, that for that character, it really is it. Maybe not the show, for the show, it is it, right?
I think there's hope for Caroline because she's got children and they're going to introduce her to things. And who knows, once Emmy goes to school, she might get her mama to go to school or she might start teaching her mama. I think that's what Tony tried to do by having the children.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So, but you don't feel like in the moment of playing that song that you're, that, that enters into your consciousness. It's more like you have to play that moment. This is the end of the line for you. Sort of, or no.
You know, people think about how, they say how hard that song is. What a joy to get a, to do a song where you get to leave it all out there.
Yeah.
That's the best possible thing you can have as an actor. And to me, Mother Courage should be that. By the end of Mother Courage, she should have left everything. Every color of the rainbow should have been able to be played and everything should be left. That wasn't possible in this production.
Right, right, right.
You know, too much of the moments that she had where she could show you other colors were gone. Pretty much all of her selling was gone.
Sure. The backstory with her kids and the, and
all
her,
that. The backstory of her kids, that sets up who this woman is and the way she deals with men. And this is a woman who can go through a war and handle men and the way she handles. So yeah, it's like, yeah, how do you go from a woman meeting people and 2 seconds later she's doing some voodoo exes with them? She hasn't sized them up enough to know that this is going to work.
Yeah, yeah, sure, sure. A lot of the cuts had to do with the specificity being taken out, the whole arguments about the Pope and the,
but I, you but know. You know what? The arguments about the Pope you didn't need, but the fact that her, that this child thought this was his father because that was who was there when he was there, and this child got this from this father, but that isn't even really his father.
Yeah,
that's,
yeah.
Character.
Yeah. No.
You can't take that away from a character.
Yeah.
And since the estate had no problem with the changing of the names, I don't understand why.
Well, that was interesting. It's also really, it's humor. It's funny.
It's funny.
And I will say, I can say this much, even though I can't review the show. There was a lot of humor in it still. There's a lot of very funny play. It's got a lot of funny stuff.
It is a funny
stuff
play,
in
but
it.
We lost a lot of the humor too.
Yes.
We did not get all of Brett's humor.
Right. No.
And, you know, when we get back to just what Brecht intended, the songs are supposed to be insertions. They're not supposed to be extensions of dialogue as
no,
in a musical.
No.
That, once again, who decides to do a show with a dozen songs and doesn't bring in a choreographer? Because Brecht intended those songs to be, let's stop the show now, and now we're going to do a
thing.
Number.
And do a thing. Yeah, yeah. No, that Brechtian alienation, right? Well, that production is going to go up and they'll get reviewed and we'll see how it fares.
I'm sure it'll be reviewed well.
I want to, you never know. I want to ask you about other, like what else you're working on. I know that someone mentioned to me that you do coaching. We call it life coaching or
I guess
career coaching?
I do do that. I wrote a book called Get Over Yourself, How to Drop the Drama and Claim the Life You Deserve, which was published by Hyperion Books. And I've coached at Omega and I've sat on panels with, you know, Deepak Chopra and Clarissa Pinkola Estes.
Right.
I haven't been doing so much of that lately because my children are older and they're now almost off to college. I got one more to get to college. You know, one of the reasons I got on council is I think that actors do not realize how powerful they are. How I believe actors are the only essential part of the theater.
Hmm.
Unless you're doing puppets or something.
But all right.
The thing that people come to see. And so actors, we're not treated like we're powerful. But I want to inspire actors to take that power. I mean, you know, once before in my career, and I won't name names, I left a show and the show ended up not happening because the entire cast left the show. And so the show didn't happen. And for actors to know, yes, that's you up there. That's your soul. That's your legacy. You can't let people make you get up and do things that hurt you and your soul and your heart to do.
Right.
Even to pay the bills.
Right.
I mean, I guess, yes, we're more lucky than someone who has to lay bricks or something, but I think some of the artist's soul dies when you're doing things you don't believe in.
Right. And you felt that was, that's harder for you to do than to leave a show. Because that's
painful
too. I do
theater because it's like a sacred thing for me. To me, it's like going to church. People come into a dark room and you get to reveal the human soul, the human spirit gets revealed, and some people are going to turn away and some people are going to embrace that. And so I consider myself like a priestess in that. And you can't pay me for that. You can't pay me for that.
Yeah. Yeah. This makes me even more want to see Your Mother Courage someday. I have to tell you, just talking to you and hearing you explain that and talk about your approach to it and to roles. I was going to say August Wilson, that Ground on Which I Stand piece. We're going to do something in the magazine, and have people revisit that. Do you feel like you were working at the time? Do you feel like, 20 years later, we're in a better place than we were in 1996 with representation and,
well, I believe that the universe is always evolving.
Okay.
So there's no doubt that we're in a better place. It may be 1 millimeter better, but evolution is always happening. Change is the constant. We know that things are changing. Do we still have a long way to go? Absolutely. And in terms of the theater, we can learn from the education system. The one thing that we know works that nobody wants to talk about and nobody wants to do is integration. And our theater companies are not integrated.
Right.
And that's not – on stage is not sufficient. They have to be integrated in their administration.
Yeah.
And that hasn't happened. And you have to say, well, if I'm a small theater company, I got to have people working for me who know people with money. Then you have to ask yourself, why don't people of color have money?
Okay. Yeah, it becomes a bigger question.
It becomes
right?
a bigger question.
Yeah.
Why is it the only people you can go to who have relationships with people with money is people who are like you? Why don't those other people have relationships with people who have money?
Right. You know, it's like the only time that you see young people of color to come see shows and they're bussed in, right, from education programs. And some of those folks do get the spark of inspiration and then go on. And that's a good thing. That's not a bad thing. But you're right. That's audiences is more than administration. Yeah, it's something that it's been a big focus of TCG, talking about how we can move the conversation for representation on stage is a whole huge topic. But then representation in the boardroom and in the administration.
Yes, it's huge. And
it's huge.
Yes, I understand that money is involved.
Yeah.
Then you need to start spreading that money around.
Yeah.
Give some money. I mean, there was a time in history when people would give people money to make them, you know, be able to have a certain title so that they could participate in things.
Yeah.
It has to happen. And I really feel that the theater is the place because we are in the room with one another.
Right.
When we walk into the theater and we see someone on stage who's, you know, aged or differently abled or a different religion that we can visually see by how they dress.
Right, sure.
Then the other is there with us and we get to actually experience all of those things we thought about that image right there. I mean, I think that's what Anna Deavere Smith's work is about.
Yeah.
Letting you hear the voices of these people who you've made decisions about because of what they look like and letting you know you actually agree with these people.
Yeah. Right. Well, no, I think for and also to do what theater can do best to really take you to emotions that you don't even necessarily talk about or openly express and have that catharsis with those characters you're talking about. You can go to a town hall and see those people. You can see them in the street or on the subway if you live in a dense city. But to go into a theater in a dark room and have that experience with them, and not just the people on the stage, but people with you in the audience, which is part of it too.
That was the most powerful thing about Rashida speaking. People. I orchestrated talkbacks with some of the greatest scholars in America, and people stayed. 90% of our audiences stayed every night for the talkbacks.
Wow.
This was a conversation people wanted to have. People went up to people who were in the audience and said, can we talk about this? Because I don't know anybody else I can talk to about this. You know, we still live in a segregated society.
That's true.
So people have nowhere to have these conversations.
Yeah.
And Rashida speaking gave people that place and that wonderful lobby at the Signature. People would just go down and have a conversation with someone who saw the play and like, I'm black and I'm white and can we talk about this?
Yeah.
Because I've been thinking about it, but I don't have anybody to talk to about it.
Well, I'd love to hear more voices in the conversation. About all these things. And I'm glad you raised yours, Tanya. Thanks for coming by to talk to us. I could say Mother Courage is playing a classic stage company, but we wish them well, break legs.
Yes.
But,
yes.
But, It's an honest difference of opinion about it. And I thank you for coming to talk about it.
Thank you for having me.
And we're back. Let's see. We just had a lively conversation offline about The Ground on Which I Stand, so expect more about that. Now we'll do some recommendations of things to think about, watch, read, see. Dee, why don't you start?
Sure. I mean, I don't really know if what I'm recommending is even possible to see at this point because it stops running this weekend.
Well, tell us about it.
So on Saturday at 9 p.m., when I should be either going out or sleeping, I was at the Public Theater at Under the Radar, and I saw this show called The Art of Love, LUV, Part 1, Elliot. And it's from a company called the Royal Osiris Karaoke Ensemble.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Where they paint themselves up to look like Grecian monks in togas and gold faces. And they basically do like a dating seminar, but in the form of a religious ritual.
Sounds interesting.
And they incorporate videos, like YouTube videos of guys talking about how you can attract women and what women are attracted to. And they speak alongside what the people are saying in the video. So it's like a karaoke experience.
Oh, wow.
It elevates the absurdism of what is being said, which is like women are attracted to confidence and success and money and all of those horrible things. And then they punctuate it with the videos of Elliot Rodgers, like the videos he made before he shot up Santa Barbara.
Oh my God.
About like, why don't girls like me? I'm gorgeous. I have so much money and cars. So it plays on misogyny in a very thoughtful and funny way, because if you're going to do a play about Elliot Rodgers, you have to do it very carefully. So
yeah.
I thought it was very effective. And I somehow feel like dating in New York City or anywhere has become a religious ritual of sorts.
Wow.
It's become a chore.
Yeah.
Yeah, religious ritual, not in a sacred, uplifting sense, but just more like a grinding,
humiliating, it's like a chore.
Sacrificial.
Yeah. You're sacrificing a part of your soul every time you sign on to Tinder.
It sucks.
Wow.
As the only single person in the room, it sucks.
Oh, and one more thing. In honor of the late David Bowie, there is now a website online called supbowie.com, S-U-P, Bowie. And if you type in your age, it tells you what David Bowie was doing when he was your age.
I know. I tried that last week. Someone put that up last week, like prophetically.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
And apparently, I am 27, and when David Bowie was my age, he was doing the moonwalk before Michael Jackson was doing the moonwalk.
So the moral of the story is that someone else will take credit for your ideas.
Yes. And also David Bowie has done more than anybody could have that has ever lived.
Yeah. I read a great quote it's from Morrissey's memoir. When Morrissey met him, apparently David Bowie said, I've had so much sex and drugs, I can't believe I'm still alive. And Morrissey said, I've had so little sex and drugs, I can't believe I'm still alive. Anyway. Susie.
Everything in moderation, listeners. Team. I guess I'm recommending this before it's opening, which technically, I don't know if that's taboo, but I loved it. So here we go. I had never seen or read the play Noises Off, and I just saw the Roundabout Theater Company's production revival of it. And it was just one of the most delightful things I have ever seen on stage. I did not stop laughing. The cast was phenomenal. I feel like that little like theater critic reviewing kid, Ian loves theater, because I'm like, it was amazing. I loved everybody. Megan Hilty, I mean, the whole cast is good. Megan Hilty stands out. She's got a very funny, like, dumb actress role that she really just, like, plays up to the nines. But it doesn't stand out because, like, they're all playing in the same show. The ensemble works together so good. Andrea Martin, Jeremy Shamos, David Fuhrer, I think that's how you say his last name, is great. Campbell Scott is great. Tracy Chimo is great. Oh my gosh, why is his name escaping me now? Oh my gosh, Rob McClure is great. Right,
yeah.
I'm forgetting people. Kate Jennings Grant,
right,
is in it. She's good. She's great. It's just great. It's just hilarious and funny, and I laughed a lot. And I think, I don't know if it's funny if you've seen the show already, but it's good.
It's one of my favorite plays ever written, and I'm seeing it Wednesday, so I'm glad to hear it's good.
Yeah,
it would have been great if they cast anyone of color in the show, but that's a whole other discussion.
Yeah, it's a whole other discussion. So
but it's great
just
to hear
leaving that out of it.
It's
but
great to hear that it's a great production of like probably one of the best comedies ever written.
Hilarious. Also, someone told me it's sold out for the entire run, but if you can get tickets, go.
I was thinking back. I've seen it a couple times. The movie's pretty good, actually. I think Carol Burnett and John Ritter and Michael Caine are in that.
I can't imagine it being on screen. There's so much about it.
Yeah, well,
theatrical.
A lot of people felt that way about the movie. But I remember a great production at International City Theater many years ago with Ron Campbell, who we recently profiled, Matthew Walker, Jodi Carlisle. God, great memories.
Gosh, it's funny.
And I will just close off, and I'm going to try not to get emotional about it. But I have been going down a little bit of a Bowie YouTube wormhole today. And, you know, you can see the entire, if you look carefully, the entire performance of Ball, the Brecht musical, or not musical, but the Brecht play with music that Bowie was in, Baal, with B-A-A-L. That's online. BBC recorded that in the 70s. And that's pretty striking. It's a little hard going, some of it. There's also something called Threepenny Pierrot. That's like the clown, P-I-E-R-R-O-T, in which Bowie's in the first section of it. This is like a mime piece that he did in the 60s. It's very, I'll use the word fruity. I think that's a dated term for it, but it's very, it's a mime piece. All right. I don't mean fruity in the gay slur way necessarily, but it's hilarious. You have to see that. And then there's other things. He's on the Dinosaur Show, as I mentioned earlier, a couple times. Once with Iggy Pop, and that's an amazing interview, just to hear Iggy Pop try to put a sentence together, and David Bowie and Dinosaur trying to field it. And there's the one I was just watching is his appearance, the Station to Station record, so it's probably 75. And he's opposite one of my childhood icons, the Fonz. And they're comparing notes on Fame. And and Nancy Walker is there, Rhoda's mother. Anyway, it's a surreal but beautiful and the whole show's on there. These talk shows, they would just sit there for like a half hour, all the people. They wouldn't just do like a bit. They would all sit there on a couch and just talk. It's amazing. So, and they would sit there and smoke, and it's definitely worth a look.
Yeah, when the day's over, I may have to go home and rewatch Labyrinth.
That's another point of entry. Not mine, but that's a good one.
Oh, yeah, that was my point of entry. I blame him for my attraction to tall, skinny, white men.
You see, I saw that movie when I was very young and was terrified by it and then avoided all things. I was like, I'm scared.
I saw it when I was a teenager. That worked out very well.
Yeah, I wouldn't have thought that Labyrinth would be the film that would make you attracted to him, because he looks very weird in that. But anyway, he looked very different in many films. I was a particular fan of the look he had in the movie Man of Fell to Earth and that Low album. But we could talk about David Bowie all day. I think that is a great way to end. You know, rate us on iTunes, tell your friends about us, like us on Facebook, the American Theater page, Twitter.
And you can find the links to all the things we talked about on the post for this podcast on our website.
Take care.